Hey everybody, just a quick note before this episode. As you may well know, it is Hugo voting season, which means your ballots are due on March 10th at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means anybody who is to the right of that gets a little extra time, which is kind of nice. So this is just to let you know that you should get your ballots in no matter who you're voting for, whether it's voting in the fan cast category, voting for your favorite novels, whatever. Just don't forget to get those ballots in. Because every vote does count. And, you know, there are a lot of great things that came out this year that really need your voice if you are, have a membership and everything and can nominate. So we'll be nominating, of course, because we were there last year. So, yeah. So thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you enjoy the episode.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Oh, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skippy and Fanti Show.
Because zombies are even scarier when they're trained seals.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And our special guest today is Mike Cole. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
So it's been a whole year since you've been on the show, because last year you had the third book in, I guess, what we'd be call a trilogy, and now we have our first standalone book, which you mentioned last year.
Yep, that's right, Gemini Cell. Last year was Breach Zone. I can't believe it's been a whole year.
It's kind of nice, though. It's a nice regular schedule for you.
I do try to stick to a book a year. I will say this. There's been a real tendency in modern fantasy to gratify binge readers by releasing three books in a year or three books in a year and a half. And I am terrified of that propensity, not because it's a bad thing, not because it's ill-placed marketing, but just because I can't do it. And I look at writers that put out 2-3 books a year, and I'm just sort of flabbergasted. I'm amazed.
So speaking of Gemini Cell, then, since you've released a trilogy of novels, and I remember you had talked, and it may be a little while since folks remember this conversation, but you talked about sort of continuing in the series and having a desire to not have it be one continuous series, but sort of bouncing around telling standalone stories and other aspects of the world. And that was kind of the impetus for Gemini Cell, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, and I've said this many times, is I don't look down on this means of storytelling. In fact, some of my favorite authors do this. Bernard Cornwell, who is hands down my favorite historical fiction author, has his Richard Sharp series, I believe, is 22 novels. 22 novels following the same protagonist through a linear progression. And it's amazing. It's wonderful. Jim Butcher does this with Harry Dresden. I'm sure you guys can think of other series that do the same thing. And it really is successful if you can do it. I can't do it. I don't know if it's a lack of ability to focus. I don't know if it's the fascination I have with ensemble casts. But even though the Shadow Ops trilogy is a linear story that with all three books are related, it's three different protagonists. And my goal was always to bounce around and to show different people. And then I read Joe Abercrombie, who did in the first Law trilogy, he did this fantastic cohesive trilogy. And for your listeners, if people haven't read Joe Abercrombie, he remains one of like the kings of fantasy as far as I'm concerned. I'm reading his Half the World right now, which is just amazing. Like it's one of those books that's so good you just want to throw in the towel and be like, why am I bothering writing? Like, I'll never be this good. Gemini Cell is... So once he finished the first Law trilogy, he wrote Best Served Cold, The Heroes, and Red Country, all three of which are sort of semi-standalone but loosely related and set in the same universe. And all three were incredibly successful. And so I realized from that, hey, there are people who do this, and you don't have to follow the model that that of the same protagonist progressing through book after book after book. So I really decided that I was going to strike out into new ground. And so Gemini Cell is a prequel of sorts, but more of a standalone that takes place in the Shadow Ops universe. But everything about it is different, from the magic system to the characters to the world that they interact with. So the goal here was to make something that readers of this original series would find familiar and could enjoy coming back to, but that new readers, and this is really important to me, could pick up without having read anything else by me.
So why the decision to do a prequel as opposed to same timeline as the rest of the Shadow Ops series, but with completely different characters exploring a different, you know, part of the world or a different facet of what's going on with the reawakening and things like that?
Because I really wanted to examine differences in magic. One of the things that I tried really hard, so the Shadow Ops trilogy has like a magical taxonomy, right? There's magic is got rules, there are schools, there's ways that the system works. And one of the things I've sort of hinted at in Fortress Frontier when I introduced Alan Bookbinder's new school and in Breach Zone with the way Limic Dampener works is that magic is really a giant iceberg floating on the ocean. We see a tiny little piece of it sticking out of the surface, but there's miles wide and deep below the water that we don't see. And that we as humans have this need to classify things and build ontologies. But the truth is that magic is pretty limitless. And I really wanted to explore something new and different. If I'd stuck with the original Shadow Ops timeline, I would have been bound by the story into that. But because of going back so far, when people are first learning how to use magic and that ontology hasn't been forced on it yet, I'm able to play around a lot more, which is why Gemini Cell has a much more occult feel and deals with, for lack of a better term, demon summoning, as opposed to and zombie reanimation, right, as opposed to the schools we're familiar with from the Shadow Ops series.
Huh. That's all you got?
No, I'm sorry.
The longer answer.
No, because I was thinking, sorry, to clarify my thoughts. I was thinking that why do you feel that if you had gone to someplace completely different, you know, not trapped into the schools and everything, because the ontology it's sort of created out of, at least for the books, out of the military aspect of it. Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem like something that would have to be enforced for everybody, for the general public.
I don't want to give any spoilers, but there are reasons why the summoning school that you see, that is the center of Gemini Cell and is also the center of Javelin Rain, the sequel, which I'm writing right now or editing right now, is not seen in the Shadow Ops trilogy. That later. There's reasons for that. I'm going to keep those close to the vest because someday I may wish to tell the readership in a book.
Dare I say it? That is diabolical.
I will say this, Render. So I'm under contract for 3 more books. Gemini Cell has been delivered. Javelin Rain's being written. That's a sequel to Gemini Cell. But the 6th book is the working title of that is Render. And if folks remember from Fortress Frontier, there's a character in that story called Render. And it follows his story back in the original storyline, timeline. So I will do some returning to that universe once Javelin Rain's turned in.
Well, excellent, excellent. So I don't think we're revealing too much if we could talk a little bit about the new magic that you're revealing here. You described it as demon summoning. Another way to describe it might be djinn summoning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not ruining too much, but I was really interested in that particular aspect because Schweizer, who's our main protagonist, his relationship with this creature, Ninip, or you may have another way of pronouncing it. I'm just gonna call him Ninip. Because it sounds cute. He would hate that, but whatever. But he has this relationship. You know, he is a soldier. He's a SEAL. He has done this job as a professional for years and years. And now he's got this sort of bloodthirsty
creature living inside his reanimated corpse, which is just a phrase I never thought I would say on this show, but that's great. So where did this idea of bringing in the djinn come from? And particularly, could you talk a little bit about that conflict that Schweizer has with Ninip, which is developed throughout?
So first of all, I want to stress that djinn is just the first – the djinn are long spirits of ancient dead. Ninip, and that's the correct pronunciation, is an Akkadian god king warrior priest from a civilization dating back to the time of Ur in Sumer. So he's an ancient, but he originally was a person. But being in the soul storm for as long as you are twists you, and also it makes you both hungry for the blood and the beating heart of humanity, but also jealously angry of people for having that because you don't anymore. But it was always critical for me to have that core of humanity exist so that the djinn would be characters, and they would have motivations, and they would have flaws and faults. And that's why a lot of what goes on in Gemini Cell is Schweizer's conversations with Ninip as he attempts to reason with him and learn about him. So I didn't want him to be I didn't want Ninip or any of the other djinn that are depicted to be cartoon character evil creatures. I wanted them all to have, you know, they are definitely diabolical spirits, but there's a motivation for, you know, why they are the way they are. And I also want to point out that we only use the term djinn because the first sorcerer who brings that to the attention of the U.S. military is from Waziristan and raised in the hills of Waziristan, being, of course, the part of the federally autonomous tribal area that isn't quite Pakistan and isn't quite Afghanistan, where it's semi-lawless. So he calls them djinn because that's what Pashto people call these spirits. But you will meet other characters. And for example, I have a sorcerer in Javelin Rain who's Haitian. She calls them Miste, which is the Creole word for the same entities that are being summoned. So what's cool, I think it's cool. I mean, I'll leave it up to the readers whether or not it's actually cool. Between Schweitzer's conflict is that Schweitzer is a person for whom warfare has always been cold and professional, right? That you dispense with emotion, you dispense with ideas of bravery, individual bravery and heroism, and you function like a machine to get the job done. And this is what in modern warfare has been proven to work. And Ninip comes from this ancient, you know, Copper Age culture where the opposite is true, that like individual passion and a warrior's name and lineage are what's important. And having those two concepts of how one fights come into conflict was a lot of fun because it was sort of like that scene in Looper where Bruce Willis sits down with his young self to talk about the same situation and the two of them are viewing it entirely differently. It's really, really cool to sit down a modern SEAL with, you know, an ancient warrior and have them talk about war and see what they think. It was a really good time.
And meanwhile, the other thing that it allows to happen is if this was a completely malevolent, mindless spirit, A, not only could those conversations not happen, which is fun to watch, but B, there can be no progression in their relationship.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, I wanted, Schweitzer at points is really trying. He reads Little Women to this ancient.
That was hilarious.
He's made awful, right? So to this ancient, you know, warrior priest who is also like twisted and desiring blood and all of those things. Like he's trying. He's trying to work something out. They're both stuck in the same corpse and they have to work together. So there's, you know, sort of almost a buddy cop element to it that I allowed it to progress along. But ultimately, you know, both of them are dead. So it does make a difference.
So one of the things that I wanted to touch on is the religious aspect of this, because your books are essentially set in more or less contemporary times. They're just, I guess you could say, an alternate history. And yet you seem to provide the answer to the age-old question about what happens to us after we die, mm-hmm. because there's a section in which Ninip actually shows Schweizer. He takes him out to show him the primordial soup of souls. Mm-hmm. And this moment for me was really fascinating, because prior to that, they'd had the conversation about the Bible, and, you know, here is Ninip saying, well, that's all just like primitive, stupid garbage, like you're an idiot. And well, he's not speaking like that. He speaks like an ancient person. So, but he's having this conversation where he's just sort of ripping apart all of these beliefs, and Swayze doesn't necessarily believe in them, but it's certainly something that a lot of people do. And then we see that moment where he takes him out and shows him that the afterlife is not all that pretty. And I was, were you at all concerned with sort of writing a book in which you provide an answer that essentially throws out most of theology? Or was this something that you just sort of imagined within the fantasy world as being consistent within that?
No, look, religion is, religious systems exist to limit human beings. I mean, that's what religion does, is it sets up boundaries and funnels people into them, and sort of and I was very determined not to have that happen in my writing. And by the way, I say that as a person who respects religions. You know, I taught medieval faith and symbolism in grad school, and you know, I've done tremendous reading in the Church Fathers and also in Islamic scholarship. So I actually come at it from a position of respect. But I also am not a person who is going to allow that brush to paint my own canvas. Like, I'm going to decide how the disposition of souls in my own universe. And the reality of it is that magic is vast and it is broad. And while you're looking at the soul storm and what Ninip shows him, you don't know if this is a place that's created by God. And you don't know if this is just the place where evil people go to die, or just where good people go to die, or just because they lacked baptism or something. Those questions aren't answered. So I don't know that I do provide an answer to people. And I don't necessarily know that I am refuting theology. I do know that I fervently, fervently hope to be accused of Satanism, because it has proven to be such an incredibly commercially successful engine for heavy metal. I certainly, Mal has, my girlfriend has a huge collection of pentagram-inspired jewelry and dresses and those kinds of things. And I grew my hair and listened to all kinds of rock music for the express reason of disturbing my parents and neighbors for many, many years. So I can only hope that it'll have the same effect in my own work.
So you heard it here first, folks. Gemini Cell is a handbook to Satanism.
That's right. If you read Gemini Cell, you will turn from the church and embrace the Dark Lord.
Yes. And then you will fight battles in you'll fight civil rights battles in Florida about whether or not you can put your Satanist textbook in school library.
And you'll play the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper backwards, and hear that you buried Paul or killed Paul McCartney or something.
It really is the most evil thing you could possibly do.
I think what's interesting is, I think it's not actually going to be the djinn or the afterlife that will get this book banned, but the fact that there's an atheist character in it.
That's right.
I'm just saying. I think that's automatic grounds for banning
many
school libraries.
I'm really nervous about Javelin Rain, because Jawed Rahimi, who's you guys know from Gemini Cell, I do his point of view in a few chapters, and he is a deeply religious Muslim. I mean, he was raised in the among basically a Stone Age culture in the mountains of Afghanistan, and Islam is the heart of who he is, and it's what he believes, and there is a tremendous amount of religious thinking and theology and how it impacts day-to-day life in him and how he relates to the world. And I do get nervous about that. We'll see what my editors think when I turn the manuscript in.
I'm glad you've said that, because yes, your stories are unconnected in some ways, but obviously connected very closely in others. We've talked about this before in our previous conversations about the other Shadow Ops books. You had said, we talked a lot about relationships. I, as a former military spouse, particularly was interested in that aspect. And in this book, you really go heavily into that relationship. And I know this seemed like a weird segue, but my brain works in interesting ways. I'm glad Jawed is going to be in a different book, because he was enjoyable to see in this one. and torturous to see at the same time.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But right now, let's why go in so in depth into relationship between a service member and a spouse, particularly with Sarah, who is quite the independent woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she definitely has, she does not need Jim mm-hmm. in some ways, although we find out later that, of course, it's a loving relationship, so she does need him in other ways. But Jim, meanwhile, they're kind of a nice foil for each other, because Jim, you know, he's got his camaraderie of his team. He's got his sense of direction and purpose from the military. And she just kind of, she doesn't need that. She doesn't need what he needs. And it was nice to see them both as separate people and in the relationship. But why has this aspect of the military life been important to you over the course of the books?
Okay, I want to jump in real quick because my question is actually related to this, because I feel that this book, and this goes to some stuff, conversations we've had in private, so how much you want to reveal is totally up to you, Mike.
That's fine.
This book, compared to the others that you've written, this one felt the most personal to me.
Agreed.
And I don't know if it was the most personal for you, but that's how it definitely felt, knowing some of the things I know about you in private.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the thing I would tack on there. That seems to be where it's coming from, is a very personal exploration.
And look, you're right. I it's so funny. When I got criticisms for Control Point, when that book was first published, for Oscar Britton's whipsawing all over the planet and being emo or whatever, one of the reasons that was tough for me to take is not because – I mean, look, there's a few reasons. One is, you know, obviously I want everybody to love my work. We already had the conversation that with Oscar Britton, I feel like I was successful artistically in what I wanted to do, but that I failed in the respect that in the course of being so successful artistically, I threw readers out of the story because they hated him so much. And if that keeps them from reading my other books, then I failed, right? So, but the thing that was really hard about receiving that criticism was that I realized that part of the reason why I'd been both artistically successful and dramatically failed is that not dramatically failed, as in hugely failed, but in terms of the drama of the story, the narrative, is that I put too much of myself into it. Is that I had unwittingly written myself into the page, and so it felt like a repudiation of me. But one of the things I've noticed is that when I read back through Fortress Frontier, Breach Zone, all the books I've published, I just can't stop it, man. Like, this is what happens. And it's the same thing here. I mean, Gemini Cell is absolutely a PTSD book. I think if you miss the allegory for PTSD in Schweitzer's being dead and then return to the world and having to, like, you know, relate to his wife and child, get back to his wife and child that he isn't separated from, and then to be back with them still separated because he's dead and that will never be fixed. If you miss that, like, you know, I don't know how I can help you. It really is the case. And it really does, I guess, reflect some of the isolation I feel. And when you deal with relationships, look, well, there's a few things here. One is, you know, I'm really interested in romance and want to get better at writing it. One is, you know, I'm extremely interested in writing women better. And doing a better job of getting those voices authentic, which is why the sex scene in that book from a female point of view was a landmark for me. And I think I've talked to you about this. Like, I've never had sex while being a woman. So that was – and one of the things that was fascinating for me is I never sat down at 41 years of age, I guess, of which over 20 I've been sexually active. I've never sat down and really thought about how a woman experiences sex. Can you imagine that? Like, I was so ashamed to realize that. Like, I've never thought about the mechanics of it. Like, how does it actually feel? What's going on emotionally? You know, and I was so disappointed in myself. And look, I fixed it. And by fixed it, I mean fixed it that I am thinking about it a lot now and had to really think about it hard to get that scene. So when I wrote their relationship, I really wanted to write Sarah – not as a strong female character with air quotes. I mean, screw that. I'm not interested in – and the Bechdel test just pisses me off. Like, I'm not interested in, like, checking boxes, right? I wanted to write this woman who was a real woman and had her shit together and didn't need anybody and was the kind of dream girl that I would want to be with. And and Schweitzer I admired for other reasons. And in the end, when I was thinking how these two would get together, like, Schweitzer is a really good guy, but he's not as smart as Sarah, and he's not as ambitious as Sarah, and he's not as independent as Sarah. And they met, and they got into it because they thought each other were hot, and they started screwing, and like a lot of couples do. And because he's a good guy, she fell in love with him, and he's also a smart guy in some ways. And the institution of their relationship built inertia as an institution, independent of who either of them were. So as the relationship developed and they had a kid and things got harder and Sarah was like, wow, what did I do here? Why am I with this guy? You know, they had a child together and they were together. And so she sort of had to find ways to sketch out what was tolerable about having him stay, which is what I have her confronting him in that first chapter, second chapter, I'm trying to reflect. But that felt really honest to me because a lot of marriages and relationships are like that. No relationship is good all the time and everyone's happy all the time. Every relationship reaches a point where the couple are looking at each other and it's the commitment to the institution that keeps them together. That's you know, not a judgment call. It doesn't mean that some relationships are bad or good. And then they, you know, you get through the trough and you get to the high point again. So it just felt really honest to have these two independent people who were maybe not that well suited for them. And to show that schism on the page. And it really was, dare I say, ambitious, like really reaching for me to deal with that.
Well, even more so, but I mean, you're exploring not just two individuals and a broken relationship, but not broken, but a normal relationship,
right?
I should say. But you're exploring the relationship between a member of the military and a military spouse, which
and a military spouse who is so does not fit. The thing with military spouses is that there's like a scene for military spouses,
right?
That exists and is geared towards supporting the unique pressures of that relationship,
right,
on the spouse side of it. But Sarah Schweitzer is having none of that. Like she does.
Yes,
not
she's particularly derisive.
Right.
At a couple points in the book, which I totally get because I had those moments myself. But yeah, she's not the typical spouse that is portrayed in most, you know, in film. I mean, people like to romanticize the military spouse, and you chose not to do that.
No way. No. And the thing is, but I romanticized Sarah Schweitzer. I mean, that is, you know, that is the girl for me. It's funny.
You know what though? You say that, but you know who else was the girl for you?
Mm.
Now I'm forgetting her name, but the character from your last couple was
Scylla. Well, but this
Scylla.
Scylla and Sarah have a lot in common in their. I mean, look, Scylla is batshit crazy and it twists her into something horribly evil. And also Scylla doesn't have any tattoos and Sarah Schweitzer has two sleeves and I'm really into that. They both are people. This is the thing that both of them do and that a lot of my male friends that I admire so much and value so much do, is that they're people that look at the world. All of us, all of our lives are being pushed in different directions and being told you do this, you do that, this is the way it is. You know, I come back to religion as an example of that. You know, millions of people do it, so you're going to do it too. And Sarah and Scylla are both those rare people that look at all of that institutional weight and all of that pressure and go, nope, sorry, I'm not going to do that. It's going to be like this. And because they're so skilled at actualizing that, in that feeling or that passion or there, that whatever that is, that je ne sais quoi, that the world pivots around them. And I have met people like this and I don't know how the heck they do it, but I love them. I love them to death.
You know, as we're talking about this, I kept thinking about that. One of the things that you do really, really well, that's related to this, obviously, is dealing with the dramatic portions of a relationship, And any kind of relationship, really. It can even be, I mean, we haven't mentioned it at all, but his relationship with his fellow soldiers in the early chapters of the book is, I mean, it's very well developed, and even later on that becomes much more important because we actually get a viewpoint character from one of his I guess you'd say former?
One of his teammates, yes.
Yeah. So, but one of the things I love is that there is that moment that you have with Sarah and him where they basically have that conversation, like, why do you keep doing this military thing? And this is not going to work, right? You can't just do this forever. And he has to make that hard call, the decision, is he going to stay in the military? Is he going to take some sort of other kind of job? And that moment is, I think, really just one of the best pieces of relationship writing I think you've done, because it's...
Well, thanks.
I kept reading that and going and just feeling it. I don't know how to describe it, but I really felt in that moment, because both of those characters have desires of how they want things to proceed. They love each other, but they each know that one of them is going to have to sacrifice something.
And this is the case with relationships. I mean, yeah. Look, love is worth it. I mean this. Love is worth it. I am no good on my own. I love being in relationships. When I was, I loved being married. Hope to be again someday. But I'm not an idiot. Like I'm sorry that I used a pejorative. I didn't mean it that way. I'm not blind to how hard love is, and how much work it is. People are incredibly complicated, and any kind of person that I would ever fall in love with, or that anyone I think would fall in love with, to be worthy of that love and to get you excited about them and want to be with them, is going to have ambition and an agenda, and it's going to be complicated, so complicated, with so many little specific facets that have to all be the same way. Everything from, you know, we always joke in couples that the man has to remember to put the toilet seat down, you know, or I like the toilet paper rolling this way and not that way, or you get sweaty when you sleep, so I want to snuggle with you. But then once we fall asleep, I need to break away from you because you sweat too much. Or, you know, there's all kinds of stupid little adjustments that you have to make for each other. And then there's bigger things. You know, I can't stand, I don't know, that there aren't four seasons here in Florida. We have to move somewhere where there's four seasons. Or I have a job opportunity across the country. And it's that constant tension of sacrifice that either person has to make that – I mean, that's what relationships are. But if it works right, then the two of you struggle, but you look back on that and you're like, wow, you know, we really weathered these storms together. And I really wanted ambiguity there, because you never know if it's going to work or not. It's a risk, right? Because you could commit years of your life to someone and then wind up losing them. But I always say this, man, love is risk. You have to play to win. And, I really wanted to capture that tension and ambiguity. I want the reader to not know, you know, well, is this going to work or isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going on 15 years and I still don't know.
Well, I can tell you what would cause you guys to get a divorce.
My husband quitting his job and opening a toy store? Oh
my God. Apparently that wasn't what did it.
Jason Momoa dressed as Aquaman.
That...
Showing up in your driveway and holding the boombox over his head.
No, you know what? I don't think that would cause divorce, because I'm pretty sure that my husband would also sleep with him. Just saying.
It would be all threesome. Yeah.
You know, it would be funny. Like, I could touch the scene of Jen like running out the door in her nightie to embrace Jason Momoa, and then I come flying from off screen and like tackle him, pull him into a
He's mine.
Stay away from my man.
I'm just imagining Mike and Jason Momoa without shirts on, just making out on the grass.
Covered in salad oil.
Oh my God. In a giant bowl.
How is it that all of our conversations turn utterly inappropriate?
They always wind up home.
God.
Yeah.
They really do.
It's terrible. We're having such a deep conversation about relationships, too. That's probably why.
It's important. It's important to keep humor. So.
Exactly. I want to bring us back because, first off, as kind of a recap of that whole conversation, I just want to say that I see Sarah as a strong female character, not because she's strong, although she is, but because she's actually a well-fleshed-out character.
Nice.
I think that's usually, to me, that's the more important aspect of a character that is female, being a strong female character.
Hey, what did you think of the sex scene from female POV?
I thought it was good, although it's a lot briefer than your male sex scene.
No!
I feel it like is that's briefer. like a jab, like a sex joke jab.
No, it was good. It's particularly good. I don't wanna spoil.
No, don't spoil anything. Don't even say who it's
exactly. But it is definitely briefer, but it is a very good description of a woman's emotions going into a scene like that. Ooh. So
did you see Monsters Ball, either of you?
No.
Do you know, you've heard of the movie?
Yes.
No.
All right. So long and short, it's worth seeing. Just like, it's like watching, you're going to feel like you got hit by a truck. It's like watching The Wrestler. You know, it's a really profoundly sad movie.
Wait, what is it called?
Monsters
Ball.
It's Halle Berry, Billy Bob Thornton.
Anyway,
Halle Berry plays this woman who's just had this unending string of tragedies.
I have not seen it yet, but okay, I remember sort
Mike,
of the...
Let Mike finish then.
Go ahead.
So there's this scene, so she loses her husband to the electric chair. She loses then her son in a car accident, and she's on the poverty line, and she's just lost everything, and she hooks up with Billy Bob Thornton's character, and they have sex. And I was watching this, and it's so well acted. It's this incredibly erotic, hot, sexy sex scene, but it's so obvious that Halle Berry's character in the scene is not trying to get sexual gratification. She's not trying to have an orgasm. She's not trying to have sex. She just wants to be out of pain because all of these tragedies have happened in her life. And so she's chanting throughout the scene. Sean, you remember this. She's going, make me feel good. I want you to make me feel good, over and over and over again. And she's weeping while she does it. And I can't, without seeing it, I can't sum up the power of the scene. But I was watching it and I was like, wow, people have sex for all kinds of reasons and expect all kinds of things, different things from it. And it sex is really complicated. And watching that scene and wanting to be able to understand it better and evoke it with the same kind of clarity. Cause whoever made that movie not only was able to teach me that sex is really complicated and different for everybody, but also what this character wanted to get from that sexual encounter without telling me, by showing me. I was just blown away. It remains, in my opinion, one of the greatest. It is the greatest sex scene and one of the greatest scenes in cinema.
I will go watch it.
You will be very sad.
I think that's probably why I haven't watched it. I have certain films that I've put on the, really complicated, you have to be in exactly the right mood to watch this movies. I have the pile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of those films that hits that pile because, you just have to be in a certain frame of mind. It's like, what was the one? Precious. I have not seen Precious yet.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if I'll ever be ready to watch Precious. I really want to watch it, though. But
yeah, that's an intense film.
It's a hard one. So,
but in any case, Jen, I know you have some questions about characters you've mentioned before. So just to make sure, back here.
I thought it was hilarious that you called it sort of a buddy cop thing. Only because one of my questions was it's more about the fact that this, in my opinion, is the most graphic novel that you've written so far.
So you're saying it's a graphic novel?
Yes, it's a graphic novel. I really hope that somebody actually turns it into one that is drawn. No, there's more blood, which is saying something. considering that how Scylla kills people. Obviously, the sex, there are sex scenes. They're reasonably graphic, and I don't remember it being that way in Fortress Winter.
So let's just say in general that there's more fluid overall.
There's more fluid overall.
Gosh, there's so much fluid.
But no, it's brutal. There are some very brutal scenes, particularly with one of the characters that I said we were going to talk about, but I don't want to actually say who it is yet because I don't want any spoilers. But it's brutal. And it seems to me that you went to places that you have not gone with the previous novels.
Yeah, and wait till you read Javelin Rain. I mean, anyone who knows my reading taste should not be surprised. And part of this is what is just sort of writing 101 in that writers are always trying to raise the stakes, always trying to outdo yourself. You're always trying to make the bar higher. You're always trying to do one over. And you see this in television. You know, Game of Thrones shows 20 sets of boobs, so Spartacus has to show 21. And Walking Dead, you know, shows this many eviscerated corpses, so the next season of I'm sorry, I don't watch enough TV to know what the next season, whatever it is, like comparison. So some of it's just one-upmanship. But if you look at my reading habits, what am I reading? I'm reading Joe Abercrombie. I'm reading Mark Lawrence. I'm reading Scott Lynch, I'm reading Peter Brett, I'm reading George R. R. Martin. These are some bleak, I'm reading Daniel Polansky. These are some bleak, bleak writers. And for me, just for me, that darkness really, really resonates. I've lived my entire life in intelligence, law enforcement, and the military, and all I see is conflict and a really, really bleak and dark world. And so for me to feel that there can be redemption or hope, it has to be won or ripped out of the essential down nature of the universe. And that's absolutely going to wind up in my work. And I see this as a good thing and something that's reflective of my taste, because if I can paint the world that I believe is real and find, you know, reasons to go on and reasons to do better in that, then, you know, maybe I can reach somebody else and make them feel the same way, if that makes sense.
I suppose in some senses it does, yes.
And fluids also.
And right? Fluids. Well, more, yeah, fluids, obviously.
More fluids is better.
That is just so...
Sorry.
Yeah, but Javelin Rain, where do you see it? It's full of massacres and I've written an awkward sex scene that I hope will rival even Joe Abercrombie, who is largely considered to be the master of awkward sex scenes in fantasy.
Is it going to involve a goblin?
No goblin.
Oh God.
Are you ever going to write a goblin sex scene? Because I've been waiting for that.
No goblin erotica yet. No goblin sex scenes yet. Although, however, I do want to say I do have a goblin point of view novelette coming out. Bain is publishing John Joseph Adams's Operation Arcana, which is a military fantasy anthology, and I have a Shadow Ops novelette in it from the goblin point of view. It's a POW story, which I'm really excited about, and I just did a blog post on it today. And it also makes me a Bane author. You know, it's so funny. I've always gone on Pals and been like, oh, you know, John Ringo and, you know, Eric Flint and David Weber and Larry Correa. Like, I'm not a Bane author. Now I am actually a Bane author. So
you have officially become the military author.
That's right.
You always wanted to be.
That's actually really interesting, because I said that as a joke about goblin erotica. But it is interesting, because I was very fascinated by the goblin characters. These are the characters that live in the sort of mist, the plane of magic, essentially. Mm-hmm. And they appear much earlier in your other work, in larger numbers. And they're actually really fascinating characters. We don't learn much about them. We learn a little bit. We get some of their culture in some of the books in some small doses, so that you're going to write a character as a POV character. I think that's going to be really interesting, I think.
I'm psyched. I mean, I'm really pleased with it. I'm very, very, but I mean, again, I gotta defer to the readers. I always am very nervous whenever I say I'm happy with something, because, you know, that's something for the audience to decide.
I'm more excited that it's a POW story.
As am I. And one of the things I say in the blog post, and I did that on purpose, is that I really feel that the military experience belongs to everyone. And I say this very emphatically, and that military engagements and militaries affect far more non-combatants than they do combatants. And I think there's a game company called 11-Bit Studios, which just put out a game called This War of Mine, which is the first war video game I've ever seen that takes place from the – you play refugees. And your goal is to, like, feed yourselves and hide and avoid disease. And
Well, that sounds uplifting.
Well, it's not uplifting, but it's important because I think –
very.
Because I think that when we talk about war, we only ever talk about warriors. And I really wanted to write a story that is – because people keep looking at me to provide this authentic military portrayal. And I think it is profoundly inauthentic to only show warfighters and never to look at everyone else who's affected by war, which is in far greater numbers.
That's the thing that continues to disturb me is even today when – you hear the news discussions about Afghanistan or Iraq or whatever. It's still almost always about like, well, we lost this many troops, and here's what's going on politically. But I don't remember ever seeing much coverage on, well, here's what happened to the city after we bombed the shit out of it, and what's going to happen next? Like, what about all those people that lost their shops or the dead people? I mean, we don't even know how many people are actually dead in Iraq who are civilians.
Nope, but I tell you this, it is at least 10 times the number of combatants, at least.
Yeah.
I mean, you're absolutely right, and it is a travesty. And I think that if we did fix that and we told those stories, that we would be a lot less likely to go to war. Because I think it is only in deliberately hiding our heads from that incredible human cost, and not just in terms of lives, but in terms of and physical degradation of environments, but in terms of how cultures change, and how industries change and develop, and how economies change in major tectonic and often permanent ways.
Yeah.
Only by avoiding that do we so casually commit ourselves to violence on that scale.
It's a problem, I think, that is at some point it's going to have to be solved by people getting fed up with the news being so piss poor at actually reporting.
Well, I mean, look, look, this may be a small blow, a fantasy novelette, but it is one I'm deliberately striking. Like, I just feel that it isn't just the kinds of stories we tell; it's the things we deem worthy to tell stories about. And what we're saying is that it's not even worth mentioning. If we're talking about a military or we're talking about war, only the guy behind the gun or gal behind the gun is the person that we really feel worthy of memorializing. And there is literature out there. I mean, everyone should be reading Elie Wiesel's Night. There isn't a single person in the world who shouldn't read that book. And it's just one example. Of fantastic literature that's written in the genre, but not nearly enough by a long shot.
Yeah. Well, since we were on that discussion of we're at that point where we should probably start to wrap up, and we're discussing your work. I mean, obviously at this point, Gemini Cell's out, and if people haven't bought it yet, that's because they haven't got my foot in their ass yet. but that'll happen.
Well, and they haven't heard that it's satanic, so
that's right.
That'll help too.
True, big selling point. Yeah. That'll be in my blurb for when I review it. The most satanic book in the history of Western literature, and I expect that to be on the cover of your next novel.
Right, it'll cause your children to worship the devil.
I feel like that would sell so many books, but people would be very confused.
Yes.
It would. I want the Church of Satan to endorse my work.
Yay! Well, they are good people with good taste, so they probably will.
Yeah.
So we have the novelette coming out in John Joseph Adams' anthology. When is that expected to come out?
That's coming out next month, March. I don't know the exact date, but it's called Operation Arcana. And it's not just me. There's a lot of great authors in there, including Tanya Huff and Elizabeth Moon. Elizabeth Moon, of course, did The Speed of Dark, which is one of the great science fiction novels. Tanya Huff is a former Canadian Navy and a great writer. Jonathan Mayberry, who has written tons of awesome comics to include Captain America. I mean, how cool is that? Sean McGuire, who's done the Newsflesh series. Glenn Cook, who is probably the most famous military fantasy author. So lots of great writers in that anthology.
Excellent.
Excellent. And what else should we expect from you? I mean, probably come next January we'll have Javelin, correct?
Yep, you're going to have Javelin Rain coming January. I have been working on a sort of grimdark medieval fantasy forever now, at least a year, and I've been talking a lot about it. But unfortunately, I haven't done it right, and now I have to do it twice. So I'm going to be – there's a lot more work that's going to have to go into that one before
I still – Is that the one about the girl?
Yep, the fractured girl. Yep. So it's just going to – I mean, look, I'm not going to give up on it, but
– Good. No pressure, but I've been waiting for it.
Oh, thanks. I'm trying to break out of this military ghetto that I find myself in where people think that's the only story I can tell. And if I'm going to convince publishing professionals to commit, you know, thousands of dollars to me and risk, you know, lots more in bringing that book to market, it's got to blow their socks off. I can't half-ass it.
That's fair.
Well, the nice thing about the military ghetto is that it's pretty big and there are a lot of things you can explore and that are really interesting, like POWs.
Yes.
Like refugees, potentially, like all those other aspects that people ignore,
but
still make a big impact. But I can't wait for other stuff to come out too.
And it's super important to me personally.
Right.
Super important to prove to myself, forget anything else, but just to prove to myself that I can write other stuff. I want to be a writer with a capital W. I want to have a broader brush. I need to be able to go to bed at night and know that what success I've enjoyed in writing isn't due to the gimmick of military authenticity in my voice when I write. I need to know that it's just because I'm a good writer.
Well, I can say that Jen and I a couple of years ago did hear the basic plot for this. Well, not the basic. You gave us a lot of detail, as I recall. And I can say the story sounds freaking badass.
Oh, well, thank you. Unfortunately, I've got...
And I can also say that I think you pretty much have, to most of us, proven that you are an excellent writer with a capital W. But I get having to prove it to yourself, too.
Yep. Always our own worst critic.
Exactly.
Perfect. So, okay, so we've got the novelette coming out. Javelin Rain will be coming out in January, so people got a little bit of time for that. For now, you got to get this book, Gemini Cell. Get it now, and then read all of his other stuff.
And the one thing with Gemini Cell I want to remind people is you don't have to have read anything else I've written. Gemini Cell is designed to be an entry point into my universe. So don't worry about the other stuff if you don't have to have read the Shadow Ops trilogy.
Right, which is a really important point I think people should know, is this is a good place you could dive in now.
Yeah.
So, perfect. Well, I will make sure there's links to your website, all that stuff, your Twitter, if you're at Mike Cole, so it's easy, Mike with a Y. I guess you've forgotten. But on that note, thanks so much, Mike, for taking time out of your evening.
Yeah. Thanks for Jen. Thanks for coming out of semi-retirement to hang. It's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on.
Absolutely. Okay. And thanks, Jen, for honestly, I'm not thanking you for anything. Forget it.
No, don't thank me for anything.
On that note, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.